Anna Mackenzie.
After Anna left, I remained on the bed, looking into the mirror from a distance of 5 or 6 feet. The face that stared back at me was haggard, almost unrecognizable. It was also jerking back and forth. I looked at the doorknob, a seam in the wallpaper, a shoe on the floor. Everything I tried to focus on did the same. I was well aware of my tendency to become consumed by thoughts, and knew I had to put what she'd said out of my mind. I'd been back on solid ground less than a day, which was nowhere near long enough to begin to panic. The seas had been so rough, and I'd been so ill, it made perfect sense that my vertigo would take time to resolve. At home, though, I'd probably have slipped off to see a specialist just to put my mind at ease. If I told Alice what was going on, he would have suggested I take a pill, and while they were probably designed for moments exactly like this, I had staunchly refused to let a single one cross my lips from the moment they'd been prescribed. Because of my mother, people were always looking for cracks in my facade, waiting, even hoping for me to return to type. My mother-in-law's shocking proclamation on New Year's Day was the first time anyone had been quite so explicit, at least to my face, but I knew what everyone thought of me, and I refused to prove them right. The ridiculous thing was that only I knew I didn't take the pills, so I wasn't really proving anything to anyone except myself. Alice found them calming, so my prescription was filled often enough to satisfy Edith Stonehide, who rifled shamelessly through my things when I wasn't there. The clock was ticking, and Hank and Alice were waiting downstairs, so I concentrated on the job at hand. Alice put great stock in my looks, teasing me that my only job in life was to be the prettiest girl in the room. I had always thought I was perfectly adept at doing my own hair and makeup, but apparently Alice thought otherwise, and immediately after our marriage, placed me in the hands of professionals. I dug through my suitcases and trunks, collecting my lotions and potions, as Alice called them, and lined them up on the dresser. At home, he liked to open the jars and sniff the contents, asking the price and purpose of each. The more expensive, the better. One time, I'd come into my room and found him at my dressing table with his face half made up. He let me finish the job, and then, for a lark, he donned my oriental robe, wrapped his head in a peacock blue scarf, and tossed a feather boa around his shoulders. Emily was entirely nonplussed when she brought up the Petit Fours, and I introduced her to Aunt Esme. She gawped as I explained that Esme was a long-lost relation and a teensy bit eccentric. After she left, we howled, wishing there was a way we could get Hank involved. We drank whiskey from teacups, and Aunt Esme read my fortune, which involved a long journey and great wealth. I asked if there was anyone tall, dark, and handsome in my future, and she informed me that my destiny involved a man who was tall, blonde, and handsome, as well as already beneath my nose. I leaned toward the mirror to have a closer look, tilting my face back and forth. The trip had taken a toll on my complexion, and my left cheek had thin red lines running across it from when I'd smashed into the outside wall. I looked as though a cat had taken a swipe at me. I patched and spackled as best I could. In the end, it was clear I'd used a heavy hand, but my face turned out better than I expected. My hair, however, was a different story. I usually wore it parted to the side, with a wave that swept across my forehead, then up and over my ears before landing in a cascade of curls at the nape of my neck. This was courtesy of Lana, the hair savant at Salon Antoine, who set my hair twice a week. She would cover my head in rollers and put me under the dryer to cook while someone else touched up my manicure. When the rollers were out, Lana would coax and pat my hair into submission, spray it until it was as hard and shiny as glass, and send me on my way. Between appointments, all I had to do was make sure I replaced any bobby pins that came out and wear a hairnet to bed. If it was necessary to smooth the surface, I was instructed to use a soft, bristled hairbrush with caution, but if anything went wrong that I couldn't fix, especially with the curls, I was to go back at once. Consequently, I hadn't done my own hair in 4 years, and had no idea what to do with the stringy mess that sat atop my head. In honor of Aunt Esme, I wrapped a turban around it, pinned a garnet brooch to the front, and went to join my husband. I kept a hand on the wall to steady myself as I went downstairs, and paused at the bottom to get my balance. The fire was burning brightly, and the blackout curtains, or frames had been pulled out and stacked in a corner. The downstairs windows were also taped, and posters on either side of the radio warned that loose lips sink ships and careless talk costs lives. Another flicker of fear ran through me. Alice and Hank were at one of the tables, poring over an ordnance map with several logbooks lying open. A duffel bag, tripod, and various other pieces of equipment were on the floor, and they had their coats and hats thrown over an empty chair. Hank watched as I wobbled over, and I hoped he wouldn't have time to come up with a joke about sea legs.
"Look who's up," he said brightly.
Ella stood and pulled out a chair.
"Good morning, sleepyhead," he said, kissing my cheek. "Or should I say afternoon?"
I smiled weakly and sat.
"You obviously got your beauty sleep," he said,
pushing my chair in and sitting back down.
"You look positively radiant."
"It's just a bit of paint," I said. "You two look busy. What are you up to?"
"A little strategizing," he said. "Thought we'd scope out the area on foot, maybe rent a boat. If there's time, we might walk over to the castle."
"Don't forget the newspaper," said Hank.
"Yes, we're going to place an advertisement to find people who've had encounters. Help us establish a pattern. When and where the thing arises, weather conditions, etc."
"I thought we were changing hotels," I said, glancing at the equipment on the floor. "Or are we going to send for our things later?"
"Yes. Well, neither, actually," said Alice. "There don't seem to be any other hotels. Hank took an early morning walk, and the village is the size of a flea. The girl in the kitchen says the next closest hotel is 2.5 miles away, but it's full of billeted soldiers, and anyway, it doesn't sound any better than this. Apparently there's no electricity in the entire glen."
I looked around to make sure we were alone. "But what if the landlord doesn't let us stay?"
"It turns out Blackbeard is much friendlier in the morning," Alice said. "Well, much, maybe putting it a bit strongly, but we've officially checked in for a stay of indeterminate length, so don't worry your pretty little head for another second."
He reached over and play-pinched my cheek. For the first time, I noticed their plates. There was a pale rectangular slab on each, gray and slightly gelatinous.
"What is that?"
"Porridge," Hank said brightly, poking it with his fork. "Apparently they pour leftover porridge into a drawer and cut slices off it when it sets. Waste not, want not."
"You're both in very good moods," I said.
"Of course," said Alice, spreading his hands. "We're here, aren't we?"
"Excuse me, Mrs. Pennypacker," said Anna, appearing at my side.
My mother's name again. I shot Alice a look, but he was watching as Anna slid a small bowl of steaming porridge in front of me, along with a cup of creamy milk.
"I'll be right back with your tea," she said.
"Well, would you look at that," said Hank. "Virgin porridge. Aren't you special?"
I stared at it. "I don't think I can eat. My stomach's still iffy."
"You have to," said Alice. "You're thin as a rail."
"Please, that's how you like me," I said.
"Yes, but if you get too thin, your face will suffer."
I looked up, horrified, wondering if he was saying it already had. I was still trying to decipher his expression when Anna returned with a cup of tea.
"I brought a wee bit of sugar, Mum," she said,
setting it in front of me. There were two cubes on the edge of the saucer. Hank glanced up from his map.
"Her tea's stronger, too. I sense favoritism." "And rightly so," said Alice. "She needs it."
The back of my throat tightened. So much for my being positively radiant. I picked up the milk to pour in my porridge. Anna sucked her breath through her teeth, and I halted with the bowl in midair.
"If you don't mind my saying, Mum, that's not the best way of going about that. Pouring the milk all over it," she tutted. "It's just not right."
"Don't you have something else?" Alice said testily. "Ham, eggs, a steak. My wife is poorly. She needs protein."
Anna drew her shoulders back.
"We do not, Mr. Pennypacker. Those particular items are rationed, and we weren't expecting guests. And for your information, milk and sugar are rationed as well. I only brought them out because I thought Mrs. Pennypacker could use a little perking up, what with her motion sickness and all."
"Thank you," I said. "That's very kind of you."
"Fine. Never mind," said Alice,
pulling the logbook toward him. When she didn't leave, he threw her an irritated glance and flicked the backs of his fingers toward her.
"I said that's all."
She folded her arms and glowered at him.
"No, you did not. You said never mind. And I don't suppose you've given your ration books to Angus?
No, said Alice, without looking at her.
Oh, aye, she replied on an intake of breath. Well, we can't do anything better for you until you do, and I'll have you know it's a criminal offence to waste food, so get that down you, or I'll be first to call the warden.
She lifted her chin and sailed around the bar and through to the back. Alice looked agog at Hank. Then he broke into giggles.
I told you she wasn't all there, he said.
Hank nodded.
She does seem a few sandwiches short.
You needn't have been so rude, I said. She's very nice, and she was about to show me if you hadn't interrupted.
Alice looked stunned.
Show you what? How to eat porridge? It's porridge. You eat it.
Oh, never mind, I said. Alice stared at me.
Shall I call her back?
No, I'm fine, I said. But perhaps you can explain why exactly she thinks I'm my mother.
Alice laughed, and Hank nearly spat tea out of his nose.
You're not your mother, thank God, said Alice after they'd collected themselves. But I did sign us in using your maiden name.
And why is that?
My father wasn't terrifically popular around here after the Daily Mail fiasco. But don't worry, when we find the monster, we'll come clean.
He held his hands up and framed an imaginary headline.
Son of Colonel Whitney Hyde catches Loch Ness Monster, hailed as hero. Say, hero, think we can get back to work? Said Hank,
stuffing his napkin under the edge of his plate. He circled an area on the map with his finger.
Since this area is the epicenter of the sightings, I think we should start at Temple Pier, then either walk or row to the...
As Hank prattled on, I considered the two bowls in front of me. If you didn't put the milk in the porridge, surely you didn't put the porridge in the milk. I dipped my spoon in the porridge, looked at the bowl of milk, felt stupid, and gave up. I put one of the sugar cubes on my teaspoon and lowered it slowly into the cup, watching the brown seep upward, evenly, irrevocably. Chapter 9. Hank and Alice seemed almost relieved when I told them I wasn't going to join them. I would have been offended if I didn't know I couldn't walk straight. They gathered their things and left in a whirlwind of activity. I hadn't seen Alice this energized since the summer I'd met him. At the last second, Hank leaned over the table, grabbed his porridge, and gamely chomped it down. Then he ate Ellis's as well, saying he wasn't keen on
being frog-marched to the clink, at least not over a slab of drawer porridge.
Ellis kissed my cheek and implored me to eat my own porridge in whatever fashion I saw fit, and to make sure the staff looked after me. And then they were gone. I had planned on asking Anna to draw me a bath, but after threatening to call the warden, she never returned. I began to think she'd left the building. I found my way up the stairs, grasping the rail and stopping several times. At one point, I thought I was going to fall backward and sat on the step until it passed. There was a black line painted around the inside of the bathtub, about 5 inches up, which I assumed was a guide to how deep the water should be, but no matter what the temperature of the water, there wouldn't be enough to warm a person up. I decided it was a suggestion rather than a rule, put in the rubber plug, and turned the taps on full. I left them running while I went to my room. When I returned and tried to step into the bath, I discovered that the water coming out of both faucets was icy. By the time I got my clothes back on and rushed down to the grate, my teeth were chattering. The fire gave off a fearsome heat, and I couldn't seem to find the right distance from it. Too close, and my shins and cheeks stung. Too far, and I got chilled through. At one point, my toes were burning and my heels were freezing all at the same time. I was cold, dizzy, queasy, and filthy. It was hard to imagine being more miserable. There was a newspaper on the low table, but when I tried to read, the words swam on the page. I gave up almost immediately, left it open on my lap, and gazed into the fire. Its movement masked that of my eyes, and was the most helpful thing yet in making me feel steady. The chimney stones were charred, and the fire, part coal and part mysterious other, hissed and cracked, and occasionally let off an unlikely whistle. As I watched, a glowing red ember shot out, landed on the carpet, and immediately turned black. A pair of brown utility shoes, thick wool socks, and reddened shins appeared, right where it had landed. Anna was standing beside me, holding a plate and a steaming cup. She put them on the table in front of me.
I couldn't help but notice you didn't eat your porridge, probably on account of not knowing how. She glanced behind her and added, I slipped a wee dram into the tea. I thought it might help, as I also couldn't help but notice that you're still a bit wobbly.
The plate held a coddled egg and a few slices of golden fried potato. Moments before, my stomach had been doing flips, but I was suddenly ravenous.
But I thought eggs were rationed, I said, glancing up. Aye, and butter, too, but we've hens and a cow at the croft. I nipped back and told Maher, that's my mother, that you were feeling poorly, and she said to give you this. She's also the midwife, so she knows such things. She says you're to start with the tea.
Thank you. That's very kind. Please send her my regards.
Anna lingered and then said, Is it really the monster your husband is after? My cousin Donald's seen it, you know.
I looked up. He has?
Aye, and his parents too, she said, nodding gravely. My Aunt Aldie and Uncle John were driving home from Inverness when they thought they saw a bunch of ducks fighting in the water near Abriachan. But when they got closer, they realized it was an animal, a black beast the size of a whale, rolling and plunging and generally causing a right stramash.
She illustrated with her hands.
What happened then?
Nothing, she said simply. It swam off.
And your cousin?
She shrugged.
There is not much to tell. He was a fisherman. Something happened one day when he was out on the loch, and he hasn't set foot on a boat since, and neither will he discuss it.
What about your aunt? Do you think your aunt will discuss it?
I should think she'd blather your ear off, given the opportunity. Why don't you invite her for a stroopach? And Mrs. Pennypacker, you were on the right track. You put the porridge on the spoon and then you dip the spoon in the milk. It keeps the porridge hot.
I'm sorry I didn't eat it, I said. Is it really a criminal offence to waste food?
Aye, several years since. But don't worry, the milk will go into the soup and your porridge went into the drawer. Connell was that pleased to lick the bowl. He wagged his tail. Do you think you'll be needing anything else? Only I need to get back to the croft. You might not think there's much to do in January, but you'd be wrong. There's clearing stones, cutting turnip for the sheep, the milking. Oh, it goes on and on.
She stared into the distance and sighed.
There's just one thing, I said. I'd love to have a bath, but there's no hot water. There will be in about 20 minutes. I heard you banging around up there, so I lit the boiler. I'll take up some Lux Flakes as well. You're only supposed to run the bath up to the line, but I think maybe this once you might run it deeper.
I couldn't take offence. She'd seen me moments after I'd quite literally fallen out of bed.
I'm off then. Meg will be back from the sawmill around four. Now get that down, you, she said, nodding authoritatively. We've seen bigger kneecaps on a sparrow, and if Maher hears you didn't finish up that tea, it's the castor oil she'll be sending next.
Although the tea itself tasted like boiled twigs, I supposed it was ersatz, the wee dram helped so much that after my bath I lay down to have a rest. I was surprised to find myself drifting off, because I was excited. I couldn't wait to tell Ellis about Anna's relatives. Several hours later, I floated out of my nap to the buzz of conversation and laughter rising from the main floor. I was surprised by the number of voices, since I knew we were the only staying guests, and decided the inn must also be a pub. I lit the candle, which Anna had replaced, and looked at my watch. It was evening, and I was hungry again. I hadn't had a proper meal since I left the States.
You're thin as a rail, Ellis had said.
I've seen bigger kneecaps on a sparrow, Anna had said.
I let my hands explore my belly. The hip bones had protruded sharply, the concave area between, the ribcage that loomed above.
Oh, Madeline, we really have to do something, my mother had said.
I was 12, and at first had no idea what she was talking about. I'd stepped out from behind the striped canvas of the changing tent on the beach at Bar Harbor, and was breathless at the deep blue of the sky and even deeper blue of the ocean, at the laughter and shrieking of the children who played at the edges of the lapping surf, at the seagulls swooping and diving. I turned, alarmed at her tone. She shook her head sadly, but her eyes were hard. She pressed her lips into a thin line as she surveyed the parts of me that made me most self-conscious. They were the parts that were filling out, but were not yet curvy. I was merely pudgy. I'd never felt a deeper shame in my life. She'd have approved now, I thought, stretching my legs out. With my ankles and knees touching, my thighs never met. And then I thought, no, she wouldn't. No matter what I did or who I became, she would never have approved. Hank's and Alice's rooms were empty, so I headed downstairs. I assumed they'd returned, discovered I was asleep, and gone down for drinks. I was eager to tell them what I'd learned, sure they'd be pleased with me. Perhaps with the right type of persuasion, even Cousin Donald would tell his story. As I stepped out of the shadow at the bottom of the stairwell, everyone fell silent. Hank and Ellis were nowhere to be seen, and other than Meg, I was the only woman in the room. There were a dozen or so burly young men wearing khaki uniforms sitting at the tables, and about six older men in civilian clothes perched on stools at the bar. Every one of them was looking at me. I girded myself, feeling the men's eyes upon me, and hoping they wouldn't think I was drunk as I made my way to the couch. Connell stared from his place by the hearth. He didn't raise his head, but his eyes darted, and his whiskered brows twitched as I approached. At the end, when I sank onto the couch, I realized I'd only been slightly off balance. I further realized that I had taken the stairs without incident, and then, with some alarm, that what I had thought was ersatz tea was almost certainly medicinal. While I wasn't happy about being dosed without my consent, I couldn't deny it had helped. Meg was behind the bar, her hair carefully arranged in a cascade of red curls. I remembered the bits of rag tied in her hair the night before. I wondered if I could figure out how to do that. My own hair, still damp from my bath, was back under a turban. Her periwinkle dress hugged her figure, and her lips and fingernails were scarlet. It was hard to believe she worked at a sawmill. She looked like a red-headed Hedy Lamarr. If she was at all open to Hank's advances, she didn't stand a chance. Hank would never be serious about a barmaid. He was so slippery, he could barely bring himself to be serious about Violet. I had to find a moment to warn Hank off, and wished I'd said something that very first night.
"Can I get you something, Mrs. Pennypacker?" she called over. "A half pint, or perhaps a sherry?"
"Nothing right now, thank you," I said. And at the sound of my voice, the men exchanged glances. I didn't blame them. Surely they were wondering how and why an American woman had materialized in their midst. A hot flush rose to my cheeks. A young man, sitting at a table with a glass of beer, called out, in an accent as flat and unscottish as my own,
"Canadian or American?"
And I found myself staring back with equal surprise. Before I could answer, the front door opened, and an elderly man came in, leaning on a walking stick. He said to the room in general,
"There's rain in it today."
"Aye, Donnie, that there is," said Meg from behind the bar. "A half and a half, is it?"
"Just the point of heavy."
He made his way to the last empty bar stool. She pulled a glass from beneath the counter and held it under a beer spigot.
"There's game pie tonight," she said, "so you can keep your ration book in your pocket."
"Oh, that's grand, Meg," he said.
He began to struggle out of his coat.
"Can I give you a hand?" she said, coming around to help.
"I'm in need of one, Meg. Surely I am," he said,
chuckling at his own joke. His empty sleeve was pinned up against his shirt. As Meg took his coat away, he climbed onto the stool. He raised his glass and turned toward the room.
"Sláinte,"
he said.
"Sláinte."
Everyone, young and old, lifted his glass. At that moment, Ellis and Hank burst through the door, cheeks ruddy with the cold, coats and hats wet.
"So if the ad runs on Friday," Ellis said, "we could potentially start getting responses on Tuesday. Meanwhile, we can revisit the..."
His voice petered out when he realized he was the center of attention. Hank let his hands drop to his sides, clenching and unclenching his fingers like a cowboy ready to draw. Behind the bar, Meg picked up a cloth and began to wipe down the counter. Our black-bearded landlord appeared in the doorway that led to the back, wearing a heavy-ribbed sweater and dark olive. After a silence that seemed interminable, old Donnie set his glass down and slid off his stool. He picked up his stick and hobbled slowly over. Tap, 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 tap. He stopped directly in front of Ellis. He was shorter by a whole head. He looked Ellis up and then down and then up again, the skin of his neck stretching like a turtle's as he strained to see Ellis's face.
"You favor your father," he finally said. I beg your pardon, said Alice, draining of color. A monster hunter. From 34. I'm not that addled yet.
The broken capillaries in his face darkened. A fleck of spittle flew from his lips. Meg's eyebrows darted up, and she glanced at Alice. Then she resumed wiping the counter.
Lie, Donny, she said. Come take a seat and I'll get your pie.
He ignored her.
I suppose it's the monster you're after, is it? Or are you going to float a balloon and take a snapshot like your old man?
Alice's face went from pale to purple in a split second. The old man spun and hurried toward his coat, his gnarled stick banging on the flagstones.
I'll no be staying where this bastard is.
Did he just say what I think he did? Alice said. Did he just call me a bastard? If he wasn't a cripple, I'd knock his block off, said Hank.
Your mummy's his wife, then, is she?
Said old Donny.
Only rumour has it that he was an awful one for the Hochmagandy.
Now, Donny, Meg said sharply this time. There's no call for that. Come have your pie.
You'll excuse the language, but there's no other way to get to it,
the old man said indignantly.
The pathetic creature, trying to make Strupican of honest girls up with a big house, and not a shred of decency. And I don't suppose anyone will help me with my coat.
This last was delivered as a statement, although he set his stick against the bar and straightened up, waiting. Mr. Ross had been studying Alice since Donnie's initial proclamation, but now he came around the bar and helped the old man into his coat. Donnie picked up his stick and stomped dramatically to the door, before turning and declaring,
I'll not be darkening your door again, Angus, not while this one's in residence.
Several seconds after the door closed behind him, someone said,
Well, I suppose Rona won't mind not having to come collect him at the end of an evening.
A swell of laughter rose, and the men returned to their conversations. Meg came around the bar and put the radio on, fiddling with the lit dial, until she first found Radio Luxembourg, with Lord Ha-Ha announcing in a perfect English accent,
Germany calling! Germany calling!
She switched to static immediately, then moved the dial around until she finally found Bing Crosby, crooning about moonbeams and stars. Alice, whose face had finally settled on a terrible shade of grey, came and sat next to me.
And that, my dear, is precisely why I used your maiden name, he said through gritted teeth.
Our landlord was once again studying him. Chapter 10 Alice maintained a cool, silent facade through dinner and excused himself immediately after. When I rose to go with him, he told me firmly to stay and enjoy my sherry. I didn't want to stay, and there was certainly no enjoying to be done. All I could think about was what we'd do if we were given the boot for lying, but I knew he wanted me to remain behind and try to save face. I lasted only a quarter of an hour. When I left, Hank was grinding his teeth and white-knuckling his whiskey. I knocked on Ellis's door.
Go away!
It's me, I said, speaking into the crack. Please let me in. He barked something about not being fit for human company. I went to my own room, hoping he'd change his mind and come to me. When the rest of the house had shut down and my candle had burned to a nub, I gave up and went to bed. I lay on my back in the dark, under a mountain of blankets, listening to the rain pound the roof. I was wearing my two heaviest nightgowns, but was still so cold I was dabbing my nose nonstop. I had never heard the words Strupican or Hochmagandy before, but deduced from the context that the former was what my mother-in-law believed my mother to be, and the latter was the activity that defined her as such. I'd long thought of the colonel as an irritating blowhard, but it had never occurred to me that he might also be a lecherer. The mere thought of the colonel making overtures to hapless young girls was horrifying. The pasty skin, the jiggling belly, the mustache yellowed by tobacco. I hadn't noticed it before, but if Ellis were bald, 40 years older, 60 pounds heavier, and had an alcoholic nose, he would look very much like the colonel. No wonder Ellis hadn't felt fit for human company. Learning that he was going to age like the colonel must have been a terrible blow, yet there was no denying it, since old Donnie had identified him as the colonel's son the first time he laid eyes on him. But there were ways of delaying the transformation, with diet and exercise, even hairpieces if necessary, and there was time to worry about that later. We had a more immediate problem to address. I flipped back the covers and fumbled in the dark for the matches, lighting my last inch of candle. A moment later, I was in the hallway, standing outside his door. As I raised my hand to knock, the door to Meg's room clicked open, and a heavy-shouldered figure slipped out. I jumped backward, muffling a gasp. The man was tall and had prominent ears, but by candlelight I couldn't see much else. He glanced at me, turned up his coat collar, and slipped into the inky black of the stairwell. I rapped quickly on Ellis's door. "Ellis! Ellis!" I said urgently, looking down the hallway. "Let me in!" A moment later, the door opened, and his face appeared in the crack.
"What's the matter? Is it your heart? Do you need a pill?"
"No, I'm fine," I said, irritated that he'd automatically jumped to that conclusion.
"You didn't sound fine."
I glanced one last time down the hall and decided not to say anything about the man leaving Meg's room. "I am. I'm fine," I said. "But we need to talk."
"About what?"
"You know what. Can I please come in? I'd rather not do this in the hallway." After a flicker of hesitation, he held the door open. By the light of my candle, I saw that his room was in roughly the same condition as mine, with his belongings strewn all over the floor.
"Watch your step," he said, sweeping his hand toward the mess.
I made my way to the bed and set the candle on the table. When I climbed under the covers, Ellis said,
"What are you doing?"
I felt like he'd kicked me in the stomach. "I'm just getting warm. Don't worry, I won't stay." He exhaled through puffed cheeks and ran a hand through his hair. Finally, he closed the door and walked to the far side of the bed. He lay on top of the covers with his arms over his chest, stiff as a slab of marble.
"You could at least have brought me a pill," he said.
"I can go get one."
"Never mind," he said.
A few minutes later, when it became apparent he wasn't going to address the issue at hand, or any other, I asked, "What are we going to do?"
"What do you mean?"
"Where are we going to go? We can't stay here."
"Of course we can. Why wouldn't we?"
"Because we checked in under a fake name." Ellis exploded, sitting bolt upright and slamming his fists on the quilt so hard I recoiled.
"It's not a fake name. It's your maiden name, as I explained to you earlier. So what exactly is your point?"
"My point is that I'm terrified we're going to be tossed out onto the street," I said in a harsh whisper. "And I'm sorry you're upset, but you have no right to take it out on me. None of this is my fault."
"So it's my fault, is it?"
"Well, I certainly didn't do anything." The wind howled down the chimney. The window rattled in its pain. "I'm sorry about the old man tonight," I said. "The whole thing was dreadful." Ellis was suddenly yelling again.
"I've half a mind to have him arrested. It's slander and libel. God only knows what else, making ridiculous, groundless accusations against someone who's not even here to defend himself. My father would never, ever..."
"I know," I said, interrupting him in a whisper, hoping that it would encourage him to lower his tone. I laid a hand on his arm. "I know." In fact, I did not know. Was he incensed about the accusations of womanizing, or the accusations of fakery, or because he, himself, had been caught in a lie? The rain picked up and changed direction, battering the glass like someone was flinging buckets of nails against it. Water dripped sporadically down the chimney and onto the grate, an occasional heavy plonk. Ellis lay back down. I was infinitely sorry I'd come and was about to climb from the bed, when he suddenly rolled to face me, catching me off guard.
"Well," he said, "to answer your question, I certainly hope we can stay. There isn't anywhere else to go."
"Maybe we can move to the estate. I'm a little surprised we didn't go there in the first place."
"I rather suspect they got their fill of hides back in 34, don't you?"
"Oh, I don't know. Your father is hardly the first man to try it on with a servant. Anyway, your family..." He laughed wryly.
"I'm a second cousin once removed. And no, even if they would have had us, which is highly unlikely, the point is moot. Apparently the house and grounds are crawling with soldiers."
"It was requisitioned. Where's the family?"
"No idea," he said. "It's not as though we've exchanged Christmas cards over the years."
He laid an arm across me, and I realized we were making up.
"So what did you do today?" he asked.
"Mostly I rested, but..." But I've got exciting news. 3 of Anna's relatives have seen the monster, and at least 2 are willing to talk to us.
Who?
Anna, the girl who served us breakfast.
Hmm, he said. How interesting.
I thought you'd be pleased, I said. Maybe even excited.
Oh, I am. I'll definitely follow up, he said. How's the dizziness? Do you think you'll be able to come with us tomorrow?
It's much better, and I'd love to, I said.
Good. We could use your sharp eyes.
He wriggled his way under the covers.
Aren't you going to put out the candle?
I realized he was inviting me to stay. I blew out the flame and rolled toward him. A few minutes later, a soft rumbling began in the back of his throat, and before long he fell onto his back. The snoring grew louder. I lay awake for what seemed like forever, blinking into the dark. I tried to remember the last time we made love, and could not. I thought about the man leaving Meg's room, and hoped she was being careful. If Hank got her into trouble, her reputation might be ruined, but she'd end up well off, at least by the time I was finished with Hank. If a regular working man got her into a predicament, well, I just hoped he'd marry her, and that they really were in love. In the morning, Ellis was gone. He had removed the blackout frame, so I woke to daylight. It was almost 10 o'clock, early by my standards. Downstairs, Anna was scrubbing the windows with a wad of newspaper. An earthenware jug labeled distilled vinegar sat on a nearby table. She had a plain cotton kerchief tied around her hair, knotted on top, in stark contrast to the bright Hermes scarf that was tied similarly around mine. She glanced at me and turned away immediately.
"Good morning, Mrs. Hyde," she said pointedly.
"Good morning," I said, slithering into the nearest chair. It was only then that I registered the absence of Hank and Ellis. Anna was watching from the corner of her eye.
"They've gone out," she said, attacking the window with renewed vigor. "They said to tell you they'd be back tomorrow."
I sat up, panicked.
"What? Where did they go?"
"Inverness, apparently," she said.
"Where's that, and why?"
"It's 14 miles up the road, and for what reason, I would not know," she said, setting the wad of newspaper on the sill and wiping her hands on her apron.
"They didn't leave a note or anything?"
"Not to my knowledge."
"Do you know if they cleared up the..." "Confusion?" I asked, wincing at the final word. She turned and glared at me, planting her hands on her hips.
"Do you mean about using a fake name? You'll have to ask Angus about that."
I was struck through with terror. If the landlord made me leave, what was I supposed to do? Where was I supposed to go?
"Any chance you've brought your ration book down?" Anna continued. "Only I can't help but notice that not one of you has handed one in, even though I mentioned it yesterday, and you were supposed to do it the moment you checked in. Although I suppose if you'll be going elsewhere, it doesn't much matter."
"I'm not sure where Ellis put them," I said weakly. "I'll have a look in a bit." Anna kept her hands on her hips, staring at me with grave suspicion. I dropped my gaze into my lap.
"I'll get your breakfast then, shall I?" she said, before stomping past.
I put my elbows on the table and dropped my head into my hands. I couldn't believe Ellis would do this to me. There had to be some mistake. Breakfast was a slab of drawer porridge and decidedly weak tea, with no milk or sugar. Anna dropped them in front of me with a clatter and went back to the window.
"Bacon, butter, sugar, milk. It doesn't grow on trees, you know," she said,
as though continuing a conversation. My hands were back in my lap. I started picking at the chips in my nail polish.
"Or eggs, or margarine, or tea," Anna continued.
She surveyed the wad of newspaper in her hand and dropped it on the table. She crumpled up a fresh sheet, tipped the mouth of the jug against it, and slammed the jug back down.
"I suppose tea does grow on trees, but not around here."
She nodded toward my cup.
"I've reused leaves for that," she said.
For about 15 seconds, I thought maybe she was finished.
"I suppose I could make you a beetroot sandwich in the meantime, although I don't suppose national loaf is up to your usual standards. Napes, tatties, onions, porridge, certainly, but no milk, mind you. You might be able to find a tablet or two of saccharin. And I don't suppose you've got a gas mask, have you?"
She glanced quickly at me, intuited the answer, and sighed grievously.
"I thought not. You're supposed to carry one at all times. You can get a fine for that. and I don't suppose the mustard gas will know the difference between you and a normal person."
She curled her lips on the last two words. I finally looked up from my lap.
"Anna, I'm sorry. I don't know what to say."
"Oh, hoy. I'm not sure I'd believe it anyway."
She might as well have slapped me. Mr. Ross came through from the back, wearing the same sweater as the day before, pants of the same dark olive, and heavy black boots. It looked like a military outfit, although there were no badges or any other identifying information on it. He stopped momentarily at the sight of me, then continued as though I didn't exist, going to the till and removing cash. He flipped through a large ledger book, making occasional notes with a pencil. With a start, I noticed that the first two joints of his right index finger were missing. Anna turned her attention back to the window.
"Shall I correct the spelling in the register?"
he said, without looking up. My relief was so great, I clapped a hand to my mouth.
"I'll take that as a yes."
"Yes," I said, barely managing to speak. "Thank you." It was more than enough that he wasn't turning me out. He had no reason whatever to preserve my dignity, and this simple act of kindness caused my throat to constrict.
"Right, then."
He slapped his thigh.
"Connell, trot!"
The tall dog trotted around the corner of the bar, and the two of them laughed.
"You're very lucky, is all I have to say," said Anna.
My innards twisted into a knot, and my hands and heart fluttered so badly I couldn't even consider lifting a fork, never mind a teacup. I pushed my chair back so hard it screeched against the floor and bolted upstairs, abandoning my breakfast.
"I've half a mind to call the warden for that," Anna shouted after me.
I turned the lock on the inside of my room and leaned against the door, hyperventilating. My heart was racing so hard, I thought I might actually keel over. If I did, it would not be the first time. The first time had been when I was having lunch at the Acorn Club with my mother-in-law and five of her friends, including Mrs. Pugh. My marriage was not quite 4 months old, at a time when I still deluded myself that my mother-in-law's gift of the hair comb indicated that she might eventually come to accept me, perhaps even grow fond of me. The ladies were discussing the despicable attack on Pearl Harbor and saying that, despite previous reservations, they now agreed wholeheartedly with the president's decision to become involved. I mentioned the sinking of the Athenia and suggested that we might have gotten involved then, given the number of Americans on board. My remark was met with silence. After a long, pregnant pause, my mother-in-law said, "You are, of course, entitled to your opinion, dear, although I, personally, wouldn't dream of second-guessing the president." She clapped her bejeweled hand to her bosom, letting her eyes flutter as she warbled the word, "dream." As the telltale heat rose in my cheeks, she continued, praising the club for reducing its 7-course luncheon to 5, in the name of the war effort. She encouraged the other ladies to chip in, telling them that she herself had instructed the kitchen staff to donate cans, as well as whatever pots and pans they weren't using regularly. There was a flurry of regret from all of them that they couldn't do more, especially from such a distance, followed by a discussion of the surprising results of Ellis's attempts to enlist.
"A complete shock, I can tell you," said my mother-in-law. "Imagine all these years, and we had no clue. I suppose it explains why he's crashed so many cars. He can't tell if the light is red or green. He's terribly upset, but there is nothing to be done. Whitney, of course, is beside himself."
There were murmurs of sympathy for both Alice and the Colonel before Mrs. Pugh leaned in conspiratorially to say,
"Of course, there are those who arrange to be turned down."
"Do you mean," said another in hushed tones.
Instead of filling in the blank, she let her eyes flit across the room to where Hank's mother was having lunch with her own friends. Mrs. Pugh blinked heavily to confirm. The other ladies went wide-eyed, the thrill of their double-cross palpable.
"Absolutely shameful, flat-footed indeed.
Nothing a pair of good boots wouldn't fix."
"That one's been trouble from the word go," said my mother-in-law. "It's somewhere in the blood, even if his mother is a wanamaker."
She lowered her voice even further.
"I wish Ellis would keep his distance, but of course, he's never paid attention to a word I say."
I was staring at the shrimp and avocado on the fine china in front of me,
when it hit me that she had almost certainly said those very same things of me to these very women, perhaps at this very table. The hair comb hadn't been a peace offering. I had no idea what it signified or why they had invited me to lunch, but by then I was entirely sure there was a motive. I remember staring at the glass bowl of salad dressing, the flute of champagne with lines of bubbles rising from tiny, random geysers on the sides. I remember realizing that I had gone still for so long, they were looking at me, and that I should pick up my fork, but could not, because I knew I would drop it. Someone addressed me, but it was impossible to hear over the buzzing in my ears. Then I couldn't catch my breath. I wasn't aware of sliding from my chair, but was certainly aware of being the center of attention while lying on the carpet, looking up at a circle of concerned faces. And who could forget the embarrassing ride in the ambulance, its siren blaring? A number of consultations followed, culminating in a visit by a doctor brought in from New York, who took my pulse, listened to my heart, and asked me extensive questions about my family.
I see, he kept saying, studying me over the top of his wire-rimmed glasses.
Eventually, he folded the glasses and slid them into his breast pocket. Then he informed me, right in front of Alice and his mother, that I suffered from a nervous ailment. He prescribed nerve pills and said I was to avoid excitement at all costs. My mother-in-law gasped.
Does this mean she can't? Does this mean there will never be...
The doctor watched as she turned various shades of red.
Ah, he said, figuring it out. No, she can tolerate a reasonable amount of marital relations. It's more a matter of avoiding mental excitement. Such a condition is not unexpected, given the maternal history.
He packed his bag and put on his hat.
Wait, said my mother-in-law, leaping to her feet.
She glanced at me, prone in the bed.
When you say this is not unexpected, do you mean such conditions run in families?
After a slight pause, the doctor said,
Not always. Remember that each generation is diluted, and any children of this marriage will have only one grandparent who was, well, how shall I put this, not quite our kind.
Edith Stonehide let out a cry and sank back into her chair. My nervous ailment immediately became a heart ailment, and although I rarely felt grateful to my mother-in-law, I did admire how quickly she'd taken it upon herself to re-diagnose me, particularly as it maintained at least the illusion of distance between me and my own mother. My mother was a famous beauty, with sea-green eyes, a button nose, and Cupid's bow lips that parted over teeth like pearls. In some women, perfect features do not add up to an exquisite whole, but in my mother, the sum effect was so stunning that when she married my father, a proper Philadelphian, society seemed willing to overlook that her father was an entrepreneur who dabbled in burlesque, revised for historical purposes as vaudeville, and married one of its stars, and that her grandfather was a rumored robber baron with connections to Tammany Hall. Her family had a fortune, his family had a name. The arrangement was not all that unusual. I was aware from my earliest memory that my mother was miserable, although the sheer magnitude and artistry of it took years to sink in. It ran through her like rot. To the outside world, she presented meekness and long-suffering, subtly conveying that my father was a tyrant, and I, well, I was defiant at best, and quite possibly criminally malicious, a situation she found even more heartbreaking than my father's cruelty. She was incredibly nuanced. All it took was a sigh, a slight misting of the eye, or an almost imperceptible pause for everyone to understand the depth of her anguish and how nobly she bore it. She was excellent at reading a room, and when the atmosphere was not right for garnering sympathy, she was witty and engaging, the center of attention, but never in an obvious way. She'd run a finger up and down the stem of her wine glass slowly, repeatedly, or cross her legs and move her foot in deliberate circles, drawing attention to her exquisitely turned ankle. It was impossible to look away. She entranced men and women alike. At home, she sulked with extravagance, and I learned early that silence was anything but peaceful. She was always upset about some slight, real or imagined, and more than capable of creating a full-blown crisis out of thin air. I tried to go unnoticed, but inevitably we came together over the dinner table. I never knew if her displeasure was going to be directed at my father or me. When I was the offender, dinner passed with icy silences and withering looks. I rarely knew what I'd done wrong, but even if I did, I wouldn't have dared mount a defense. Instead, I shrank into myself. On those nights, I got to eat, although she scrutinized every morsel that went into my mouth, as well as how it got there. On the nights my father was in her crosshairs, the choreography was very different. Her contemptuous looks and snide remarks progressed to masterfully crafted barbs, which she would ignore until they ripened into cutting sarcasm, which she would also ignore. She would then, her eyes brimming with tears, wonder aloud why we both delighted in torturing her so, at which point my father would say something precise and lethal, usually to the effect that no one was forcing her to stay, she needn't feel obliged on his account, and she would flee the table, weeping. My father would continue to eat, as though nothing had happened, so it fell to me to fix things. I'd abandon my food and trudge upstairs to her locked bedroom, my dread increasing with every step. It always took some negotiating, but eventually she'd let me in, and I'd sit on the bed as she regaled me with the ways her life was a wasteland. My father was capriciously cruel and incapable of empathy, she'd tell me. She would have left him years ago, except that he'd sworn she'd never see me again, had even threatened to have her committed to an insane asylum. And did I know what happened in such places? She'd given up every chance of happiness for my sake, out of pure maternal love, although I was clearly ungrateful. But she supposed she had herself to blame for that. I took after my father. I could hardly be blamed for my miserable genes, and since I was there anyway, would I be a deer and fetch her a pell? 20 minutes after running away from Anna and the drawer porridge, my heart showed no signs of slowing down. I was slumped against the back of my door, still gasping for air. My hands and feet tingled, the edges of my vision sparkled. I hated that I'd been prescribed nerve pills, hated that anyone had seen any kind of parallel between my mother and me. And although it filled me with self-loathing, I found myself crawling to my luggage and digging through it, throwing dresses, slips, scarves, and even shoes over my shoulder in my search for the brown glass bottle that I knew held relief. I found the pills and swallowed one, swigging water straight from the pitcher to get it down. I lay on the bed and waited. After a few minutes, a comforting fog began to settle over me, and I understood, in a way that frightened me, why Ellis and my mother were so fond of them. I sat up and looked around me. My room was a mess. I'd been living out of my luggage since our arrival, taking for granted that at some point my hanging things would magically be hung, the rest folded neatly in drawers, and my empty trunks and suitcases stored. I realized quite suddenly that this was not going to happen. After I put everything away, I made my bed, although it was painfully clear that it was an amateur effort. I tugged the corners and padded the surface, but my adjustments only succeeded in pulling it further askew. I decided to quit before completely unmaking it again. I had run out of things to do. I had some crossword puzzles, a murder mystery, and a handful of books about the monster that Ellis had instructed me to read, but reading was out of the question, not because of dizziness this time, but because my brain was dulled. I walked to the window and looked out. The sky was bright, although a solid cloud the color of graphite loomed in the distance. The row houses across the street were a combination of white stucco and pink limestone, with wide brick chimneys. Beyond the houses were hills dotted with sheep and fields defined by rows of trees. In the far distance were even higher hills, uniformly brown where they weren't forested, their peaks obscured by cloud. The cold was insidious, and eventually I pulled a quilt from my badly made bed and draped it around my shoulders. I settled into the chair. Perhaps Anna had misunderstood. Perhaps Ellis and Hank had just gone on a day trip. Perhaps they were finding a new hotel. I heard footsteps in the hallway, and from the sound of doors opening and shutting and water running at the end of the hall, I gathered Anna was making up the other rooms. A few minutes after she went back downstairs, I heard and felt a door close. I went to the window and watched her ride down the street on a dark bicycle with a big wicker basket, her coattails billowing behind her. Chapter 11. I found myself gripping the windowsill, lightheaded and weak. The feeling came over me without warning. My brow was suddenly pricked by sweat, and I realized I was going to either faint or be sick. At first, I thought it was a reaction to the pill, then recognized it as hunger. The showdown with old Donnie the night before had left me unable to do anything but pick at my dinner, and other than the egg and few slices of potato Anna had given me the previous day, I'd eaten virtually nothing since we'd left the States. I'd felt this way before, in my early teen years, and knew that if I didn't eat something very soon, I'd collapse. Because there wasn't even anyone around to find me, I had no choice but to go to the kitchen and scrounge. I would find the drawer porridge and take just a small slice, the slice intended for my breakfast, to mitigate my crime as much as possible. Halfway down the stairs, I was hit by the aroma of roasting meat. It smelled so good, my mouth watered, and it almost brought me to tears. Anna had made it very clear what my diet would consist of until I produced a ration book. The front room was empty, so I slipped behind the bar. I was pretty sure I was alone in the building, but paused at the doorway anyway, listening for signs of life. I heard nothing and went through. The kitchen was larger than I expected, as well as bright. The walls were whitewashed, and the doors and window trim were cornflower blue. Copper pots, pans, and ladles hung from hooks over a sturdy table in the center of the room. A large black stove emanated a gorgeous amount of heat, as well as the heavenly aroma. There was a pantry on one side of the room, and in the opposite wall, quite literally, was a bed. It was completely recessed, with paneled wooden doors that slid on a track. They were currently open, showing bedclothes much more neatly arranged than my own. I supposed it was where Mr. Ross slept. I marveled at the contents of the pantry, jar upon jar of preserved red cabbage, pickled beetroot, gherkins, marmalade, loganberry preserves, OXO cubes, Polo and Worcestershire sauces, baskets of onions, turnips and potatoes, enormous earthenware jugs of vinegar with spouts, canisters labeled tea, raisins, and sugar. It went on and on, and I could see even more behind the glass doors of cupboards. It was a basket of apples I couldn't resist. A bushel basket, full to overflowing. Most of the apples were individually wrapped in newspaper, but a few lay exposed on top, shiny, round, and beautiful. I felt like Snow White, or maybe even Eve, but all thoughts of virtue and drawer porridge fell away when I laid eyes on that fruit. I was in the act of lifting one to my lips when a female voice spoke from behind me.
"Find what you're looking for."
I jumped and spun around, simultaneously dropping my hand and curling my wrist, hiding the apple behind my thigh. Meg was standing just inside the back door, wearing a thick olive-colored coat and matching cap. She had a cardboard box labeled anti-gas respirator slung over her shoulder by a length of string, which she set on a chair by the door. She put her hands on her hips and looked at me.
"Can I help you with something?"
"No, thank you. I swallowed hard and clutched the apple. Her eyes ran down the length of my arm. Then she looked me in the face. After a pause of 3 or 4 beats, she turned around and took off her coat, laying it over the back of the chair.
"When you have a minute, Angus wants me to show you the Anderson shelter."
She removed her cap and fiddled with her hairpins, keeping her back to me. I realized she was giving me time to either pocket or return the apple. I leaned into the pantry and placed it gently on top of the others. "Shall I get my coat?"
"You can if you want, but I'm not taking mine. We won't be but a minute," she said. "He just wants you to know where it is so you can find it in the dark. The blackout, you know. Can't even use a torch to cross the yard. Although, to be fair, using a torch during an air raid would probably not be the very best idea."
Despite the pill, my heart tripped. The Anderson shelter was out back, beyond a large vegetable garden. Except for a few rows of sturdy cabbages and chard, the garden was covered in straw. The shelter looked like an enormous discarded tin can, half-swallowed in dirt and sporting a thin layer of anemic sod. Moss clung to the sides, and a thick piece of burlap hung over the opening.
"So here it is," said Meg, lifting the flap. "You can go in if you like, but there's not much to see. Just remember there are a couple of steps down and 2 bunks at the back. We've got torches and bedding, in case we have to spend the night. Keep your coat and shoes handy. Bedding or not, you'll be wanting them. I've got a siren suit myself. You pull it on over everything, zip it up, and off you go. Have you got any clothing coupons left?
I shook my head wordlessly.
Well, never mind. I can get my hands on a pattern if you want to make one, although you'd have to come up